Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. The financial crisis has pundits weighing in on the future of newspapers. Decrees have ranged between the death of the medium to better prospects after the country climbs out of this recession. The clamor sent WFPL's Elizabeth Kramer to see if local newspaper executives are rattled.
On a sunny afternoon, Louisville lawyer Finnis Price is at the dog run at Tom Sawyer State Park. While the dogs play, he's reading.
This is a Kindle. It's by Amazon, and it uses what's called e-ink. I use it to read all of my books. I also bought it because I'm an attorney.
Despite the sun's glare, the ink is clearly legible, making it easy for Price to read his book and depositions for work. He turns pages using a side button, and using a small keyboard, he can make notes. The device saves him the hassle of lugging around a lot of papers. He also has subscriptions to the Washington Post and the New York Times, which get downloaded onto this 8x6-inch device via a wireless connection. This month, a larger version of the Kindle took stage at a much ballyhooed press conference with Amazon and New York Times executives. And some industry leaders say e-readers will save newspapers from disappearing. That's not a popular idea downtown at the Courier-Journal, where in this sprawling press room, there's a thick scent of ink and paper as comics roll off the presses. Some pundits say the recession coupled with the rise of digital media could silence all of this, but not the paper's president and publisher, Arnold Garson.
It's just become sort of the game of the moment to speculate whether newspapers will survive.
That game includes talk about the Kindle and the recent silencing of the presses at several metro papers. Some newspapers have moved their content online, and other large organizations are in financial dire straits. Garson says some of these newspapers were competing with other dailies when most cities can only support one. And advertising revenues at all papers are falling, making papers saddled with debt struggle to make payments as revenues fall.
We're in the middle of the worst recession in 80 years in this country. And we newspapers derive our revenue from auto dealers and realtors and businesses that are hiring and major national chain retailers. All of those business segments are under pressure right now.
According to a recent report, advertising brought in nearly $50 billion for newspapers in 2006. In 2008, that fell 23%. Now that revenue is in a free fall and prompting even papers with healthy profit margins, including the Courier-Journal, to reduce space and have employees take furloughs. It's also happening outside metro areas. Shelbyville-based Landmark Community Newspapers owns more than 100 newspapers nationwide. In January, it announced furloughs at all papers. But the move is no indication newspapers will become irrelevant, says Landmark's president, Mike Abernathy.
Community newspapers reach more people far and away than any other medium. In fact, there's no close second. And from an advertising perspective, there is no better way to reach those communities than through our newspapers.
Abernathy and Garson say digital media will definitely be a stronger part of the future business model, but won't eliminate print journalism. Some experts working to develop journalism on e-readers expect the same, with continuation of the industry's long-established business model. Roger Fidler is with the University of Missouri School of Journalism, and he's working with papers across the country to devise best practices for displaying news and ads on e-readers.
The traditional business model of newspapers, of deriving revenue both from advertising and circulation, is not a dead model. It will continue to survive and evolve in the e-reader model.
Back at the park, local lawyer Finnis Price, e-reader in hand, has similar thoughts.
People just are going to read newspapers always, but I think there's also those types of people that want it in a different format.
But critics say the bigger issue is that cutting news space and reporters to maintain profit margins will undermine quality journalism. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
It's a part of Louisville's history that most who grew up here are familiar with, although not everyone's memories are good ones. Fontaine Ferry Park, better known to the locals as Fountain Ferry Park on the Ohio River, was home to Hilarity Hall and Gypsy Village and rides like the Comet and the Whip. From 1905 through the late 1960s, families from all over the area enjoyed the park, but during much of that time, its doors were closed to African Americans. The 64-acre amusement park was segregated, and by 1969, the racial tensions reached a point that ultimately led to the park's closure on opening day of that year. An exhibit dedicated to Fountain Ferry Park has just opened at the Fraser International History Museum in downtown Louisville. WFPL Susan Sweeney Crum talked with Fraser spokesperson Krista McCone about the exhibit, the good times, and the controversy surrounding the park.
We are so excited about this. I think we're excited about it for a lot of different reasons because folks from Louisville, when you say Fountain Ferry Park, so many people you talk to, their faces just light up. You can see the emotion and the memories that it kind of ignites. And, you know, we're trying to capture some of that nostalgia and some of those feelings in this exhibit. And it's also a way to really explain to folks how we're changing our mission. A few years ago, as you probably remember, we changed our name from the Fraser Historical Arms Museum to the Fraser International History Museum. We changed the name, but we haven't done so much to really change the museum until now. And our new executive director, she came, I guess, about a year and a half ago. She's really got this wonderful vision of how we can live up to that new name. And Fountain Ferry is a great jumping off point because not only is it history, in a general sense, but it's local history. And I think a lot of folks are going to find something that they can connect with. For folks, you know, more in my generation who didn't get to go to the park, I think there's still something attractive about that sense of nostalgia and the good old days, so to speak, that a lot of people are going to find really fun.
Was this your executive director's mm-hmm. idea, and where did you get all the stuff that you're mm-hmm. putting into this exhibit?
It was kind of, from what I understand, a collaboration among the folks in our exhibits department. Again, talking around to try to say, what can we do that's in line with our mission and also local. And Fountain Ferry Park, the idea kind of came up, and one of our exhibit staff really took this idea and ran with it and quickly found that there's a lot of memorabilia, a lot of artifacts, a lot of things that we could pull together, photos, oral histories. There was a lot of material to work with, so to speak. And it quickly sort of took off from there. I think we started working on this exhibit about 2 years ago. And slowly, you know, kind of collecting things and talking to people. We've got about 50 oral history interviews that we've done that will also be incorporated into the exhibit. And it just kind of took off from there.
So you obviously are counting on a lot of people who, and just a little bit older than me, who mm-hmm. I've got brothers and sisters who went to Fountain Ferry Park. So
yeah,
and a lot of people who grew up mm-hmm. in that part of town, mm-hmm. and it was their neighborhood, and are looking forward, I would think, to seeing this.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the really cool thing about this is it's not only about the amusement park, it's not only about Fountain Ferry Park, but it's about that site, about that piece of land, and sort of telling the history of Louisville through that site. For example, a lot of people don't realize that it was a boat landing before it became an amusement park. Mm. And we basically take a look at that progression of how that area became Fountain Ferry Park and then how it became no longer Fountain Ferry Park and sort of the forces that led to the closing of the park and pose the question, what would it be like if Fountain Ferry Park was still here? Mm. So we're really trying to say, you know, how far have we come in 40 years and how did this really important landmark affect the history of this community that we live in? And I think, you know, that's pretty interesting because it's not just about, you know, artifacts in a case that you can't touch. Mm-hmm. It's a lot more engaging and a lot more broad in scope than that.
This was a time when a lot was happening in that part of town, mm-hmm. and the neighborhoods and the communities and society in general.
Yeah.
And so you were talking a little bit about what sort of ended in controversy, mm-hmm. but it just, there were a lot of factors going on
sure.
at the end of Fountain Ferry's existence.
Well, when we set out to really start putting this exhibit together, we didn't want to tell just one side of the story. I started off talking to you about, you know, the happy memories and the sense of nostalgia. And that's a really big part of Fountain Ferry and what it was. But there's also some controversial sides to it. As we say, we're kind of telling the story from the carousel to the controversy because the park closed amid racial tensions. And that was one of the things that led to the final close of the park, along with some of the other things you mentioned, white flight, which was obviously a nationwide trend in communities around the country that contributed to the decline of that neighborhood, which obviously contributed to the decline of the park. But the park went through so many things. I mean, there was the Great Flood of 1937. that the park survived. Mm. Before that, of course, there was the Great Depression that it made it through just fine, probably because the admission rates were so cheap. Mm. I think it was a nickel to get in back then. And then they finally raised it to 10 cents. but then, as you said, the civil rights movement and the park was integrated, I believe, in 1964. So for the last several years, the park seemed to be, you know, everything seemed to be going along pretty peacefully until some forces came together on closing day in 1969. And that ultimately led to the closing of the park. And not coincidentally, this summer, this May, actually, when the exhibit opens, is the 40th anniversary of when the park closed. Mm. Mm-hmm.
So actually, in that particular year, what was opening day became closing day
That's
as well.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right, which is a really interesting story. And it poses a lot of questions. Why did that happen? You know, were the riots so bad that was, you know, kind of the final straw, or were there other things that led to that? So we kind of delve into that a little deeper. And also, you know, beyond the end of the park, we really take a close look at the heyday mm-hmm. of the park. We've got some things that I won't divulge at this point, but I think people who went there are going to be mm-hmm. really excited to see. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of things that were actually in the park itself, thanks to our friend Joe Lay and mm-hmm. a lot of collectors around the area, and some things that we are recreating that are really going to hopefully kind of harken back to those days when people kind of just spent their time under those big lazy trees. And I didn't get the opportunity to go there, but I've seen just some amazing photographs of what this place was. And when you drive by there now, it's kind of fun to imagine what it must have been like, because it was definitely a landmark.
Today, is it part of Chickasaw Park or in that area?
It is in that area, right. And there are folks who know a lot better than me precisely kind of how that lays out on the map. But my understanding is it's kind of in the Chickasaw and Shawnee Park areas, what we now call West Louisville, mm-hmm. Which is right there on the banks of the Ohio River. Beautiful location. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is it, are there interactive or hands-on sort of exhibits as well?
Yes. You know, what we wanted to do is we wanted to broaden the appeal. You know, there's lots of young families who've never been to the park who probably aren't going to get the same thing out of it that somebody who is 60 years old and remembers it really clearly. So we've got some fun games and some, as you said, interactive elements so people can see what it, you know, might have been like if you'd gotten to go. Mm-hmm. We also have a lot of really great events and activities planned throughout the summer. And we have a really cool microsite, which is a mini website that's particularly for the Fountain Fairy exhibit. And if you don't mind, I can give people that address. Mm-hmm. It's fromyourmemory.com. And if you don't remember that, you can just go to our website, and there's a big link on our homepage. But we ask people to go on there and submit your memories. You know, upload a photo, tell us about what you remember of Fountain Fairy Park. Was it good? Was it bad? Was it ugly? We want to know all those stories, and it's kind of a great, you know, kind of forum for people to share those. There's also, as I said, a link to all the calendar of events that we've got planned for the summer. And we're doing something really fun. And I had to do a little bit of arm twisting to make this happen, but I think it's going to be a cool opportunity for a lot of folks. We're doing nickel days. A few times throughout the summer, we're actually providing nickel admission to the Fraser International wow. History Museum. And that's because back in the day, when Fountain Fairy Park was open, you probably have heard about that, but they frequently did nickel days where you got in for a nickel, which is really hard to imagine these days. But we are actually going to reinstate that and let people into the museum and to this exhibit, which is free with admission, for just 5 cents.
Wow.
Yeah, but there's lots of other stuff planned, and I encourage folks to go on there and check it out. For example, we're doing a Gypsy Village night. And Gypsy Village, for those of you who don't know, Gypsy Village was kind of a nightclub. Mm. It was, you know, the young happening place to be when Fountain Fairy was open, and a lot of really well-known national acts came through there. There was a young skinny kid from Hoboken, New Jersey, that played at the park. We know him now as Frank Sinatra, but he was at Fountain Fairy, and the Tommy Dorsey Band. There's a whole big list of them. that actually played at the park at Gypsy Village. Mm-hmm. So Gypsy Village Night is in July, and we are going to try to recreate some of that with some music from days gone by, and we've got a really wonderful rooftop where we're going to have some dancing under the stars going on. Wow. Not dancing with the stars, dancing under the stars. And it's going to be a whole lot of fun. I think it's one of those things, if you went to the park, you're going to love it. And if you didn't go to the park, but you're like me, you're into swing dancing and all that fun stuff, it'll still be a cool event for people. So, again, I encourage people to check that out. It's from yourmemory.com.
Great.
Yeah.
And this is strictly limited because it was sort of reincarnated at some point after it closed as the ghost town on the river. But, exhibit is...
And there was actually another one after that, I want to say, was Glen Park.
Yeah.
There was three different, you're right, three different... attractions at that location, but everybody kind of says, you know, it was never the same. And I know you have memories of going to Ghost Town on the River, which I think kind of had a westerny theme.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And whereas Fountain Ferry was much more Victorian, you know, your traditional amusement park, kind of the cousin of Coney Island.
Mm-hmm.
It had that really traditional amusement park kind of feel, and the others just didn't have the same thing. And so they were there temporarily, but obviously didn't last. And then ultimately all bits and pieces of the park got, you know, kind of torn down and sold off. And it is what it is today. So, yeah, it's just really interesting to take a look at that whole thing and think about how far have we come in 40 years? Mm-hmm. Just 40 years ago, we had race riots that closed a major attraction in town. And today we've got an African-American president. And so we are having, for example, a panel discussion that's specifically about sort of that topic to get people talking. We view it as our role not to portray one side or the other, but to tell the full story and get people thinking about these sorts of things and what's happened here in our community. And I think this is probably a new thing. A lot of people are kind of like, huh? Why is the Fraser Museum doing something on Fountain Ferry? But this is who we're becoming, and this is, I think, a good first step toward doing that.
The Fountain Ferry Park exhibit at the Fraser Museum continues through September 8th. More information is available at our website, WFPL.org. Still ahead on today's program, Robin Fisher chats with Kentucky author Mary Ann Taylor Hall about her new novel, At the Breakers. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. And is available at area booksellers. More information is available at our website, WFPL.org. Still ahead, a special photographic exhibit is coming to the Abbey Road on the River Festival in Louisville this week. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. Just in time for summer vacation, Kentucky author Mary Ann Taylor Hall has released her new novel, At the Breakers. It's a story that reads like a Springsteen song, with young love, loss, and growing up. Taylor Hall's book explores the themes of everyday life. WFPL's Robin Fisher spoke with Taylor Hall about her work.
So this is your second full-length novel after Come and Go, Molly Snow.
Yes.
Did you have second novel jitters since Molly Snow was so well received?
No. Molly Snow was an awfully hard novel to write, and when I finished it, I thought, I'm going to have to learn an easier way to write a novel. And so I jumped in. I had a short story that I had started back several years before. And so I started writing this book, and it went so easily, and I was entertaining myself so much. And I thought, oh, I finally figured out how to write an easy novel. And then, at the end of it, I understood that I had opened a can of worms that was going to take a while to figure out, and as it turned out, it took about six revisions and 6 or 7 years to write the novel that I thought was going to be so easy. So I'm going to have to write an easy one next.
Well, you mentioned that it came from a short story. In doing a little research, I found that it originally also had a different title.
Yes.
Why the change?
Well, I thought that, the name The Breakers was very significant in the book, since the woman is, you know, metaphorically at that place in her life. And I tried other titles, and they stuck for 3 or 4 months at a time, but I always came back to that one. It's a very quiet title, and I think subject to misinterpretation. There are so many famous hotels named the Breakers in up and down the East Coast, but this is just a very unpretentious little hotel on the Jersey Shore. But I just, you know, the book named itself, I guess.
I think that sort of works in your favor that there are so many hotels with that name, because you have a sense of at least where the book eventually is going to take place.
Yeah,
just
somewhere
from the title.
Near the sea.
Right, somewhere near the sea in a hotel. let's talk a little bit.
Not Newport. But
and not Palm Beach.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the main character, Jo Sinclair. Mm-hmm. She's a grown woman in the book. She's 42, 4 children, divorced several times. But, you know, each time it was mentioned that she got pregnant and married at 14, I was startled and sad for her.
Yeah.
And I'm curious as to why you made her so young.
Well, I wanted to write a novel about the repercussions of an early pregnancy on the life of a young woman, and the lives of her children, really. I've been interested to see in responses to the book that that people talk about the series of wrong choices she's made, and very little is made of that early pregnancy. It seems to me to be a defining factor. I have a friend who is, as a matter of fact, a novelist to whom that happened. In her first sexual experience, she got pregnant and had a child at 14 years old, 15 years old. She got pregnant when she was 14. And when I heard that story and understood what it meant for her life. You know, I think that people often stereotype young women who get pregnant early and have to, you know, have to be parents at such an age. I think often, you know, the pregnancy is a result of great innocence, as it was in the case of this child who was going to a Catholic girls' school and really knew nothing. So I kept revisiting that notion and found I wanted to write about it. The significance of it, fictionally, and also in my friend's life, was, you know, that foreclosed a lot of options for her, and she had to wait to grow up until she was beginning to be middle aged. So that was the starting point of the book.
I thought that it was an interesting conversation between Jo and her mother in the kitchen at Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
When she was sort of asking her mother, how could you have let this happen to me?
Yeah.
And her mother more or less said there was no other option.
There was no other option for them. They had the option of not sending the child away to have the baby in isolation in a place she didn't know. And I think that was, you know, their great failure. They had reasons for it too, but in this book, it seems to me that to have been divorced from her family as well as from her adolescent life was a big trauma, and she was coming to terms with it, making wrong choices based on that first difficulty in her life for the next 30 years. And so I think that when she comes to that hotel, she comes to it from a violent episode with a man, and she's having to run away from that situation so that she's forced into a situation in which she really has to take hold of her life or forget about it, you know. And I think that's that's always an interesting situation to write about.
Let's talk a little bit about her violent encounter.
Yeah.
Your description was harrowing.
Yeah.
Very realistic.
Yeah.
I thought, and I thought her reaction to it was also very realistic. I think that we can all easily, we have all been in relationships where we can see that bad things are happening and you just can't quite believe it.
Yeah.
What I found so interesting about it was that while the book is in no way a thriller, and I don't want to give that impression to the listeners, there is some aspect of it after she flees from him that as a reader, you are always looking for him.
Yeah.
It's sort of hanging over her, at least for a good part of the book. And I felt that sort of made her more real.
Mm-hmm.
Because she didn't just, okay, run away to the hotel, I'm going to paint the hotel. You know, there was this menace.
Well, you know, it's very hard for women who have been abused by men to find a way to lose themselves. I think that becomes a real big terror in their life, that they're going to be found. I came upon, you know, I decided I had to write that. It was practically the last scene I wrote. But the fact of the matter was that she came into the present of the novel bearing such a heavy load of the past and all of her past mistakes. And I felt I needed to, instead of alluding to them, I really had to dramatize the heaviness and the confusion that had accompanied her, and it seemed to me that that was the inevitable thing that would have been the culmination of her difficulties in life. And you know, I think that it was very fortunate for her that she knew somebody who knew the chief of police in that little town, because this, I don't want to give the plot away either, but
right.
that seems to me to, you know, that isn't necessarily what would have happened to in such a circumstance. You know, a lot of women feel completely unprotected and are waiting for the guy to show up again. So
it was interesting for that particular man to sort of be her culmination in a way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he truly represented each bad thing that she had learned from her husband's. he was all rolled up into one, and you can see as you get further in the novel and you learn more about her, you can look back at what you learned about Hank and see how and why she was attracted to him.
Yes.
And sort of grow with her as she comes into her own and realizing, you know, I don't
thank you
have
for,
to be
for,
this person.
Thank you for seeing that in it. That's exactly what I meant to show. You know, that's open to question. You know, she has very, you know, her judgment is flawed when her mother says that to her. You know, you have no judgment. There's a certain justification for saying it. She herself says, she can't trust herself, and you want to be able to trust your instincts and your physical responses, and hers are marred. And that's a terrible situation to be in, it seems to me. And I think one of the things that she's doing in the book is learning to trust herself.
You know, one way, of course, she's doing that is learning to trust her old English professor, Victor.
Yeah.
And there's a funny scene in the book where she's with Victor and all his writer friends.
Uh-huh.
And there's a whole lot of ego going around.
Yeah.
And you know a lot of writers.
Yeah.
And so I wondered if this was just sort of a friendly little jab at them as to how they might look to the outside.
Well, I've been at that party a couple of times. And, yeah, it's, and particularly, I want to say that I am very, grateful and touched by the kind of friendly camaraderie there is among writers, that they, you know, there's a whole lot of ego going around, it's true, but they are, you know, often, creatures of great kindness, and that scene was just having a good time.
Well, that's,
you know,
you made the comment in there that they were all great raconteurs, is that what you said?
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, it's, I can see that. I have been in that group.
Uh-huh.
And,
I bet you have.
And when you are in the group, you, it's funny, but you know, when you're an outsider, you just want to walk up to an outsider and you just want to say, it's okay, just roll with it. You know, just roll with it and eventually you'll be
part of it.
Find your footing. Right.
Well, it is very funny, too. You know, and it is true. And I would say it was particularly true for poets, oddly enough, not for fiction writers. I mean, maybe this is an off-the-wall generalization, but often they're really like stand-up comedians, a lot of these guys. They're and women too, but mainly, you know, I guess I'm thinking of the men poets that I knew. No, they can entertain you all night with their stories and jokes and tales of daring do.
Well, you know, speaking of writing, Marianne, you write novels, poetry, short stories, nonfiction. Do you have a favorite?
Well, my favorite right now is poetry because I don't have much time to write, and you can, I have found for myself that I can fit poetry into the time that I have. You know, fiction, right? A novel, it seems to me, is just terribly hard work. You know, you have to enter that world and create it every day, and it calls for vast amounts of time and concentration. And at least for me, it does. I think that there are people who have an easier time working, but I'm infinitely distractible and have always, I mean, that's why it, I guess that's one of the reasons why it has taken me so long to write these two novels, although when I've been working on them, I work on them with great concentration and determination, you know. I wrote Molly Snow by getting up at 4 or 5 o'clock every morning and working while I, you know, while the telephone wasn't ringing and when I didn't have to run off and do this or that. And that worked very well for me. I find now that I can't get myself out of bed at that time of day. So I wrote at the Breakers in a more
reasonable time
sort of way. but I think that writing a novel is really, I mean, to write a short story, you have to have that kind of concentration too, but it doesn't, you know, you can see the end in sight in a way that often you can't with a novel. You embark on it and you don't know where you're going, and you don't know how long it's going to take you. So And especially when you're having to revise over and over again and find your way through it, Joseph Conrad said that writing a novel is like taking a boat up a river with endless forks in it, and you keep on taking the wrong fork and having to back paddle out of it and find the main course again. And that certainly does describe my experience in writing a novel.
Marianne, thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you, Robin. Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with Marianne Taylor Hall about her latest novel, At the Breakers. It's part of the Kentucky Voices series published by the University of Kentucky Press and is available at area booksellers. More information is available at our website, WFPL.org. Still ahead, a special photographic exhibit is coming to the Abbey Road on the River Festival in Louisville this week. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Howlett. This week, the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater comes to the Kentucky Center. The company was started by Alvin Ailey in 1958 with a group of young African-American modern dancers. Ailey created 79 ballets. Although he died in 1989, his legacy lives on through a company that performs his works and continues to commission pieces by other choreographers. It also lives through a program between the company and Fordham University in New York. And it's there where Akira Lacey, a 19-year-old from Louisville, has just finished her freshman year. She took dance through an outreach program supported by the Kentucky Center and later studied with the Louisville Ballet School. WFPL's Elizabeth Kramer asked Lacey how it all started.
I was at Louisville Central Community Center, and I was in dance classes there with Miss Andra.
How old were you?
I was 9, I believe. And I started out, I didn't used to like it. But then I started to like it more and more, and this was through ArtsReach. So now I got to perform more, and then I realized I really liked to perform, and it started to grow on me. Then they saw that I was more interested in it, Miss Woods. Then I got a scholarship to go to the Louisville Ballet School for the summer.
How old were you then?
11.
And why did you keep pursuing dance?
It was giving me something to focus on. It was something that interested me. And it was something I could work on that I wasn't good at because I started so late. Most people, when they start dance, especially like ballet, they start like 2 and 3, like really young. And I started so late, and it was like a challenge for me. So it really something I had to work on. And once I was seeing results, then I just wanted to keep doing it, and it made me feel good. And then I started to appreciate it and love it and understand it more and more. And then I was performing, and that was the better part of it.
And you came from a ballet background. So when was the first time you heard of Alvin Ailey?
I had a teacher at Louisville Ballet, and she saw that I didn't have that much technique in modern. And she could tell that I didn't have that much technique because it was my first year taking the class. But she said that I was, like, a good mover, and I was taking up space, and I was trying. She was like, have you ever heard of Alvin Ailey? And I was like, no. And she was like, you should audition for the summer program.
And how old were you then?
That was summer of 05, so I was 15.
And how did the auditions go, and where did you go for the auditions?
The audition was in Atlanta, and the company just happened to be performing that same night. So I had an audition, and it was a good, like, 200 people in the audition, and they made cuts. And found out that it was 12 of us that made it.
And did you see the performance then afterwards?
That was like a reward. So the fact that I got in and then I saw the company. And then well, back then, I didn't really know. But I was like, oh, my gosh. So I thought after the program, I was going to look like that. I was like, that's what I want to look like.
Do you remember the actual dances that you saw?
They always do Revelations because it's like a signature piece. So I distinctly remember Revelations.
What was your impression of Revelations when you saw it?
Revelations? They're all spiritual songs. They're very, like, religious songs, hymns and Negro spirituals. So I recognize all the songs, first of all, because I go to church. And then it was more heartfelt, more soulful type dancing, and I really felt them. And I just really adored the company. And I'm like, this is like a beautiful company. This is really where I want to be. This is what I want to do. It showed me where you can really relate your love for dance, and it can show an expression while you're dancing.
What was it like when you actually got to take classes?
I was just so happy to be there, and I was 15. It was a four-day of classes. We would start at 10 o'clock in the morning, and we would go, and we'd have ballet and Horton and Graham.
These are all techniques, because yes. Horton and Graham were choreographers.
Yes, Lester Horton and Martha Graham, and those are modern techniques. And so we took both techniques, and I had a rep, which is repertory, which is, that's where we learn choreography.
And what did you learn about the Alvin Ailey style?
Before I came, I had only had ballet and a little bit of Graham, but not that much. And so when I came, that's when I got introduced to Horton. And Horton is very linear, and it's all about the lines and the shapes. But you're moving through the shapes while making the shapes. And something about it, like, I was really drawn to it because everything's, like, parallel. And because I did start late, like, ballet is more like you use a lot of turnout, and you're training your body to move in a certain kind of way. And it's the same thing for Horton, but it was new to me. So being the person that I am, I really wanted to, like, dig in and really learn it. It was easier for my body, and it worked for my body, and I was interested and eager to learn it. And I could see the basis around this, like when you see Ailey posters, because before I came, I was looking at posters and looking up Ailey online and stuff, and I could see a lot of the positions that the company would be in on posters, and that's where it came from, the Horton technique.
And now you're living in New York City and going to Fordham University, studying for a Bachelor of Arts there and studying with the Alvin Ailey School. What is it like to be there now, and what are you learning about dance that builds on what you learned during those summers?
I'm at a whole nother level of dance. Up until now, it's always been about technique, and working on ballet, and working on Horton and Graham. And now I'm to the point where we're trying to transform into an actual dancer and getting ready for it to be in the real world, in the dance world, because it's a lot of people that want to dance, and you have to be able to have technique, but also show personality in an artistic style while dancing. So now I'm transitioning, and it's a little bit harder, but I'm working on a stage to where I can have technique, but I can also have movement within the technique and be myself dancing.
And what do you hope to achieve during your time at Fordham and even beyond?
I'm actually doing a business minor, so hopefully, in Ailey too, which is the second company, and then actual first company later on. Then after like a long dance career, hopefully, I want to have my own school for the arts.
Well, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
That was WFPL's Elizabeth Kramer speaking with 19-year-old dance student and Louisville native Akira Lacey. More information about the various dance programs and the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater is available at our website, WFPL.org.
Let me take you down.
Some rarely seen photographs of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones taken during their first tours of the U.S. in the mid-1960s will be shown in Louisville later this week. They've been on display for the past 3 months at the Not Fade Away Gallery in New York City. I spoke with gallery director Larry Marion about the exhibit that will be part of the Abbey Road on the River Festival in Louisville, May 21st through the 25th. Where and when were these photographs discovered?
For the last 20 or 25 years, I've made my living as one of the top rock and roll memorabilia experts, working with all the major auction houses, discovering collections and bringing them to market. And about a year or so ago, I got a phone call at my office, and a gentleman said he had some memorabilia that he would like me to appraise and possibly sell for him. So I asked him to tell me about it, and he said, well, my dad was the Beatles and the Rolling Stones U.S. tour manager from 64 through 66. And after I recovered from hearing that, I made an arrangement to meet with him, and he came over to my office. And his dad had saved maybe 20 or 30 pieces of memorabilia, not really a lot of stuff. Basically, credentials, tour logs, some thank you notes the Beatles and Stones had given them, a silver desk set the Beatles gave him as a thank you. And I appraised everything, told him what it was worth, and he said, great, sell it. I just bought a house. I need some money. And then reached into his duffel bag and pulled out a notebook and handed it to me and said, well, do these have any value? And I looked at them, and they were contact sheets. For those of you who don't know what contact sheets are, they're like little thumbnail sheets of a roll of what would be on a roll of film. That's how photographers work. And I looked at them and picked up my loupe and looked at them carefully, and the photos were truly extraordinary. And I told Alex that that the photos were really beautiful, but contact sheets had minimal value unless he had the negatives and owned the copyright. And he told me that his father had taken all of these pictures and that he did have all of the negatives and that he believed he owned the copyright because he was the only surviving heir. So I called a friend of mine who's a copyright attorney and told him the story, and he said, yes, indeed, Alex does own the copyright. And Alex and I made an arrangement and formed a company and opened Not Fade Away Gallery, along with a few other partners. And that's how these photos came to be revealed.
Were the negatives in good condition?
The negatives were in near perfect condition.
Wow.
They had been stored properly in glassine envelopes in a moisture-free drawer for 40-something years.
What did you think when you saw them?
I had never seen anything like them. In 20, 25 years of working with rock and roll memorabilia, this is the most astounding discovery I've come across, and I've come across some real incredible items.
So what do they depict? Are just various performances and things like that?
Well, particularly at this period of time, 64 through 66, which is when the Beatles and the Rolling Stones first came to America, both, you know, the managers of both groups were very, very protective of their image. So the photographic evidence and documents from this period of time are mostly photographers hired to take publicity photos or album covers or journalists covering a story. There are virtually no photos from an inside perspective, and that's exactly what these are. Bob Bonas, being their tour manager, also became their good friend, and they allowed him to just shoot whenever he felt like shooting. You know, imagine a relative of yours shooting at your Christmas party. You don't think about the fact that someone has a camera.
Right.
So these are extraordinarily intimate, unguarded, candid photographs of the Beatles and Stones on stage, off stage, backstage, in the studio rehearsing, getting their hair cut, going bowling, just sitting around the poolside, on an aeroplane traveling. I mean, everything you can imagine that normal people would do, you know, that rock stars would do when they're not on stage being rock stars.
So the Bonas, did he just forget about them, or he just wasn't interested in exploiting them?
No, he was never interested in exploiting them. He had been approached to write books and tell his story time and time again, and he felt that it was a privilege to work with the Beatles and Stones, and he didn't want to appear to be trying to capitalize on that experience.
So you're taking these on the road now, correct?
Yes, absolutely.
And you're going to be coming to Louisville?
They're going to be coming to the Abbey Road on the River Festival in Louisville.
How many photographs are in the display?
We'll be bringing about 25 photographs, about 25 to 30 different framed images and several special prints that we've made just to make available to the fans at the festival.
And of course, you've had them out in your gallery. What's the response been to them?
The response has been overwhelmingly internationally as well. We got such extraordinary publicity when we opened the gallery on March 4th. We had an opening night party where Keith Richards' daughters, Alexandra and Theodora, hosted and played DJs, and all kinds of celebrities showed up. And we've just had an unbelievable amount of press coverage all over the world, so we've been getting a phenomenal, phenomenal response. In fact, the show was supposed to end on April 14th, and we ended up extending it through May 17th, so it's just coming down here in our gallery. All of the items are available to view on our website, notfadeawaygallery.com.
And you will be at Abbey Road on the River starting May 21st, correct?
That's correct. Thursday through Monday, we will be exhibiting these photos at Abbey Road on the River.
Great. We look forward to seeing them. And Larry Marion is the director and founder of the Not Fade Away Gallery in New York City. Larry, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.
A link to the Not Fade Away photographs and more information about the Abbey Road on the River Festival is available at our website, WFPL.org. You can learn more about today's show or start an online conversation on our blog at WFPL.org. You can also email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. Studio 619 is produced by Louisville Public Media. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.